1900, Brewster County, Texas. Covered in red dust and dripping in sweat, a man rises from his makeshift workbench on the Texas plains. He breathes a heavy sigh of relief and wipes the sweat from his brow. Using an array of chemical and geological tests, he's now certain of what he thought he knew. There is for sure cinnabar here. Cinnabar, that red-colored mineral most notable for the fact that it can be refined into mercury. And oh boy, is mercury useful. It's used in everything from common household goods like light bulbs and thermometers, all the way to scientific instruments, and even explosives. This man, Jack Dawson, is not the first person to find cinnabar here. He's not even the first American, but he's an experienced quicksilver miner, and he's here on business. Jack is here on behalf of two local cattle ranchers that have become his business partners, T.D. McKinney and his father-in-law, Jess Parker. The two suspected there may be cinnabar here when they noticed that the fires they used to brand their cattle produced small globs of quicksilver on the nearby rocks. Quicksilver is just a name given to mercury due to the fact that it's liquid and mobile at room temperature. Native Americans, though, had known of the ore's presence for decades, if not centuries, and had been using it in illustrative works and personal adornment for some time. There's also evidence that Mexican companies were aware of the deposits as well, but the land was largely regarded as treacherous due to bandit and Native American activity. The mountain range nearby, the Chisos Mountains, had nicknames like the Mountains of Misery and the Gate of Lamentations. But all that reputation doesn't matter, because in no time at all, this isolated land would have its own post office and swell to a population of over 2,000. It would come to be known as Terlingua. It would become one of the most important mining operations in the United States and supply the U.S. military for World War I. And just as quickly, it all but vanish. Welcome to Texas Town, a brief dive into the history of the small and sometimes forgotten places that make up Texas. I'm Tony, and today we're taking a look at two towns shaped by economic influence. Company towns, boom towns. You gotta get while the getting's good, after all. There's all sorts of reasons that towns spring up. Beautiful geography, strategic advantage, but towns shaped principally by economic influence tend to burn bright and fast. Texas has its fair share of these types of towns, and what it lacks in name recognition, there are no Hershey's or Pullmans here, it makes up for in quantity. Even to this day, towns thrive and die in a matter of years when demand for natural gas hits a certain sweet spot. Terlingua, or Three Tongues, was so named by Mexican herders because of the three native languages spoken nearby. The Comanche, Shawnee, and Apache all lived in the region. The town itself was migratory in the early years of its life, because in that time the buildings and tents that composed the young town were frequently just relocated to be nearest whichever mine was producing the greatest amount of ore. The most influential mine in Terlingua was operated by the Chisos Mining Company. That company was founded by Howard Perry, a Chicago capitalist who won a claim to the land for some reason. Some accounts say he got it by collecting on a debt, others say he won it in a card game, and others still report he got it by cozying up to a local rancher. There's a lot of local legend like this, but regardless of how he got it, we know Perry and his company were one of the reasons the town boomed and put down roots. He ended up building a mansion overlooking his operations, though he rarely spent any time in it. To be clear, Perry was not a kind man. He was certainly a successful businessman, but he largely found that success at the expense of his workers. He paid some Mexican laborers as little as 50 cents per day. White men were paid much better, sometimes earning up to $4 per day at one point, depending upon the type of labor they performed, though most seemed to have earned around $1 to $2 per day working for him. Of course, you don't get to take home all you earn, and I'm not talking about taxes either. The Chisos Mining Company operated its own company store, which would deduct your tab from your month's wages. And as you might guess, there were few other places to shop around. Perry also charged for access to medical services, though those charges were typically much more reasonable. One example shows that a man paid $1.25 for that month's medical fees and about $6 for supplies at the company store. Although all that said, it wasn't uncommon for some men to take home as little as $2 per month after all the fees were accounted for. At its height, Terlingua, by some accounts, supplied as much as 40% of the nation's mercury production. The town would swell and grow as demand did, and for a time it even had an ice cream parlor. In the 1930s, it got a cinema, the Chisos Movie Theater. As you might expect, the World Wars brought significant business to the town, but shortly after the conclusion of World War II, demand fell precipitously and the town's largest mine closed. The theater would fall into disrepair in the 1940s, with the material of its roof being sold off for scrap metal. In the 90s, it would get new life as a restaurant and be rechristened the Starlight Theater, so named for the roofless state it was in for many decades. Today, Terlingua has a population of just 82 people. It's embraced its status as a ghost town and is now home to many hotels, due in large part to its proximity to Big Bend National Park, of course. It also has a gorgeous community garden, a farmer's market, and is host to the Terlingua International Chili Championship, which is now in its 54th year. Perry's mansion was renovated into a hotel in 2015. There's no phone or cable service, but you do get Wi-Fi. But let's transition here and stretch our definition of a boomtown a bit. If you'll indulge me in that liberty, we can learn about the history of Rio Rico. It's hard to find much early history on Rio Rico. So much so that I haven't been able to locate any records of when it was first settled. That's alright though, because things don't really get spicy there until the 1920s, and we're mostly interested about what happened near Rio Rico, not necessarily in it. In 1905, the Rio Grande Land and Irrigation Corporation was founded. The corporation was principally concerned with capitalizing on a railroad moving into South Texas and promoting agricultural development by providing, well, land and irrigation services. They got concerned that an S-curve was forming in the Rio Grande River that would have potentially led to their property flooding and their water pumps running dry. So, naturally, not a year after their founding, they illegally redirected the Rio Grande River. Now, on its own, this sounds like your run-of-the-mill corporate misbehavior. What's a little ecosystem destruction between friends? But it gets a lot more interesting when you consider that the Rio Grande, at the time, served as the legal border between the United States and Mexico. Meaning that those who lived in Rio Rico now lived in Mexico. For quite a while, this went on without much notice. The US government did slap the company with a fine and ordered them to place border markings, but they never did it. The United States never relinquished its rights to the land, and Mexico just administered it as if it were any other town, providing schools and other government services. That's not to say that nobody noticed, though. In 1923, former U.S. Attorney General Alexander Palmer, who had served in the Wilson administration, had his European honeymoon interrupted when he was summoned to an international tribunal in London seeking to prosecute English interests in the river redirection. Luckily for Alex and his itinerary, the tribunal didn't get far and was dismissed in short order. He and his wife were able to continue on with their honeymoon and go on to visit France as well. Fun fact, they were both each other's second spouse, with Alexander's former wife dying less than a year before his new wedding, and Margaret securing a Reno divorce in 1916, Reno being famously loose for the time with its divorce laws. Eligible bachelors both. With Prohibition taking hold in the 20s, Rio Rico boomed in 1929 and became a hotspot for Texans looking to drink, gamble, and bet on dog races. The best dogs in those races were, of course, named after nearby valley towns. Brownsville, Edinburgh, Harlingen, McAllen, just to name a few. By some accounts, more than 7,000 people were present in town to witness the grand opening of a suspension bridge. Yes, by all accounts, Rio Rico boomed. Some local legends even connected Al Capone to the town. But Rio Rico's unique geographic status ended up earning it another kind of attention. In 1967, U.S. geographer James Hill began to untangle the complicated mess that was Rio Rico. His findings culminated in a border dispute, and a court case in the 70s ended up with the U.S. relinquishing all rights to the town and ruling that anyone born there, up until 1972, was legally an American. This led to a mass exodus of Americans leaving the town, along with a flood of people trying to prove that they were, in fact, born in Rio Rico. They were met with increasingly skeptical local officials who administered quizzes about the town's history to verify the people's stories. The folks who had lived in Rio Rico termed themselves Los Americanos Olvidados, or the Forgotten Americans. Today, per the most recently available census, 267 people live in 67 homes in Rio Rico. But it's not isolated by any means. Nearby border town Nuevo Progreso is only 15 minutes away by car and has a population of over 10,000. So yes, booms come and go, but often towns, and even many of their people, remain. Thanks for listening to Texas Town. That's all I've got for you today. Hopefully the music was a little bit more balanced this episode. If you have any more feedback for me, I'd love to hear it on Twitter at TexasTownPod, or you can use the hashtag TexasTown. If you're interested in Terlingua, you should definitely look up Kenneth Baxter Ragsdale and his book, Quicksilver, Terlingua and the Chisos Mining Company. It's the definitive history of Terlingua, and this episode relied heavily on his work. Our music was composed by Brian Ellis. You can hear more from him at brianellissound.com. That's B-R-I-A-N-E-L-L-I-S sound.com. Once again, I want to shout out libraries and librarians. This podcast would not be possible without them. Even when you can't go to a library in person, librarians are still available via email to help you with research or even just hook you up with ebooks or other digital content. I hope you have a happy new year. Thanks again for listening.